It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, another Wisconsin author joins us to share their year in reading, writing, and living. BJ Hollers, Eau Claire-based nonfiction author, joins us today. First, the Electoral College is casting its votes today for the next president of the United States. Voting continues until early tonight. It's usually a formality. The electoral tally is expected to once again confirm President-elect Joe Biden's victory. Wisconsin's 10 electors voted earlier today, just an hour after the state Supreme Court rejected an attempt by the Trump campaign to throw out over 200,000 ballots in two counties. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How are you feeling now that Wisconsin's electoral votes are officially cast? Do you have questions about what happens next? Do you think President Trump's allegations of fraud will keep impacting our politics in the years to come? If you voted for President Trump, do you want Republican lawmakers and others to find more ways to challenge the results, or do you think it's time to move on? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Maurice Shepard is an instructor of political science at Madison College. Maurice, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, Rob. How are you?
Good. Well, Maurice, this is usually a formality. We don't usually pay this much attention to the Electoral College, you know, casting the ballots that we knew they were going to cast weeks ago. It is getting more attention this year. Could you talk a little bit about why people are focused so much on today?
Well, President Trump, he has really placed a spotlight on the entire process, on the electoral process, how campaigns are actually conducted, and actually how votes are counted. So unlike most other presidential election cycles, we're paying extra attention this time to the actual mechanics of electing a president in a way that we haven't before.
Talk about where the mechanics go from here. As anticipated, states are casting their votes. Eventually, at some point, we'll hit the point where President-elect Biden has the official electoral votes to win the presidency. What happens then between now and Inauguration Day?
Right. So today, what happened is, again, the electors in each state met. They cast their ballots in each state. They will have a certificate of vote. That's sort of the formal official record of, once again, the electors for each state. There'll be six copies of those. Just as an interesting note here, the certificate of vote and all the other materials are available publicly in the National Archives. So if anyone's really interested in seeing the actual document, the signatures and everything, they're on there. So those six copies will be distributed to the vice president, who is also the president of the Senate, the archivist of the United States, the Wisconsin Secretary of State, and also to the closest U.S. District Court. And those certificates have to be distributed by December 23rd. So there's a deadline coming up before we get to January 6th. After that, we move to the joint session of Congress on January 6th. 2021, where the new Congress will be in place, and they will then actually go through the formal process of counting the Electoral College votes.
And as you say, the formal process, but at each point now, there's been a challenge and there's talk, and this has happened before and it didn't go anywhere, where some members of Congress challenged the electoral count as it came in. And we're expecting to see at least some of that from some Republican members of Congress this year. What kind of things are on the table there?
Well, there's a lot that can happen. Again, a lot of this is very transparent. We can go back and look at the electoral count for the 2016 presidential election. And at that time, the Democrats, they did provide some disruption to a usually quiet process in terms of allegations of, again, sort of voter fraud and these sorts of things. So the expectation is going into, again, this upcoming count of the vote that Republicans will, they will challenge, again, some of the returns from the different states. And at the joint session, it's the vice president that will once again preside over that'll be Vice President Mike Pence. He will have a group of tellers that will read each state's electoral vote. And when those votes are read, then there is an opportunity at that point for members of Congress and their formal challenge rules, where you can make a challenge in terms of a state's electoral vote. The key here in terms of the standards is that if it requires two members of Congress, one member from the House of Representatives and one from the Senate, and they have to have a written objection laying out, again, that for whatever reason, there's something irregular or not proper about the vote. And if there is one member from the House and one member from the Senate, and they have a written objection, they can actually slow this down. I think according to the rules, they will have to recess for a maximum of 2 hours in both chambers to review the allegations, the charges. And the only way that according to the rules, that a state's votes can be excluded is if both chambers vote and agree to exclude those votes, which doesn't seem very likely since the Democrats will have control of the House. And we're still uncertain about the Senate right now.
Talking to Maurice Shepherd from Madison College, political scientist there, looking at today's Electoral College voting and what happens next between now and Inauguration Day. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Maurice, once the Electoral College voting is done, do you think it's likely that Republicans will start to back away from their challenges to the election, even if the Trump campaign itself doesn't? There's a new lawsuit, I think, today in New Mexico, for example. Do you think that this will be a turning point in the conversation?
Just in terms of politics, as Machiavelli would say, all politics is short term. I think ultimately what will happen is the Republican Party will go back to its conservative roots, conservative ideology. There'll be some members of the Republican Party that have a more reactionary ideology. They may not be as willing to sort of settle down. But I think ultimately there will be an acceptance of Joe Biden as the legitimate president of the United States.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Say, what happened over the weekend with the Supreme Court pretty much indicates it was garbage in, and the court threw it out as garbage. And frankly, I think a lot of the garbage was sour grapes by the Republicans. They really had no substance, no witnesses. So I just think it's sour grapes on their part.
Bob, thanks for the call. And Maurice, we had a lot of court cases, and as Bob indicated, basically no wins for President Trump. One small one when it came to setting aside a small number of votes in Pennsylvania in case they were successfully challenged later, but not really much came through the courts on President Trump's side.
Yeah, and I think Bob is right in terms of, again, sort of the quality of the evidence simply wasn't there. I will say, however, that one thing that could happen is with all these court cases, regardless of the actual outcome of the cases, one thing that the Republicans are doing that may actually be beneficial to everyone is putting a light on our voting administration, electoral rules, and things of that nature. That even though, again, the Trump team has not been successful in court, in the long run, there may be some benefit here in terms of making sure that we take a proper look at our rules and regulations as they relate to voting and elections.
And one thing this reveals once again is elections are run at the state and local level. There's not a nationwide standard. Each state can do things differently, and often localities within that. And I think, Maurice, is it fair to say that's led to some confusion for people looking at a state that does things differently and assuming that they're doing it wrong?
Exactly right, Rob. There's an issue in terms of political knowledge and what I would call sort of political intelligence. A lot of people get a lot of political information, but they don't really understand how it all fits together. As you're pointing out, a key here is the issue of federalism, that we have American federalism. We have a national government, state and local governments. The two work together, but there are also areas where the two are separated. The Constitution makes it clear that in terms of the administration of elections, it is up to state governments to handle that. So as you point out, there have been a number of individuals that somehow make the assumption that, oh, if the national government just comes in, it can sort of take over the process. But that is constitutionally, that is not going to happen.
We're talking to Maurice Shepherd, political science instructor at Madison College, looking at today's Electoral College vote ongoing. Wisconsin's electors have already cast their votes. And what's next in the transition process and where the political parties are headed from here? You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about the process? Do you have thoughts on the politics? Do you want to see more challenges to this year's election results? Are there changes you'd like to see or clarifications you'd like to see on our voting process here in Wisconsin? Even if it doesn't change election 2020, do you think things need to be more clear? Are there things that you think we're doing wrong right now that you'd like to fix? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Maurice Shepherd from Madison College, political scientist there, talking about what's next in the presidential transition process as the Electoral College vote continues around the country today. Back to your calls at 800-642-1234. Scott is with us in Green Bay. Scott, hi. Scott, are you there? I don't know. Let's try Steve in Danbury. Steve, hello.
Hi. There's been no fraud uncovered. There's been no cheating uncovered. And these sinister allegations that Trump's been making for over a month now have done nothing but unravel the rather delicate strands that are holding our democracy together right now. And Senator Ron Johnson has been at the forefront of all this, and now has indicated that he won't rule out challenging the results in Congress on January 6th.
Steve, thanks for the call. We don't have a lot of time left. Maurice, Steve raising the concern that the constant allegations of widespread fraud without proof of widespread fraud could be damaging to our system of representative government, Maurice.
Yes, I think Steve is onto something there. There can be, there's a difference between conditions and problems. A condition you can live with and you can manage. When you have a problem, now you really have to put resources toward it. So we have issues within our election, voting and election process. I don't know necessarily if they rise to the level of problem. But Steve is right, though. Having this, you know, once again, these allegations, they're dangerous. They can weaken collective belief in the American political institutions, in political science and comparative politics in particular, when we try to identify what we might identify as sort of a weak state. Some might be Russia, Brazil, Nigeria, for example. One of the hallmarks of that is the lack of strong popular support in the belief that the government is legitimate, or there's serious, once again, issues in terms of the legitimacy of the government. So I don't think we are there yet, but you know, this is a dangerous path to go down.
Thanks for the call, Steve. We'll go to Sue next with us in Amherst. Hi, Sue. Oops, Sue, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Go. What did you want to ask about, Sue, or bring up?
I'm sorry. A little connectivity issue. My interest in this entire process is simple. They're really... the timeline has not allowed for in-depth investigation into any of the allegations yet. They have been summarily dismissed by multiple courts as saying that the evidence is too thin and et cetera. And of course, there hasn't really been an honest media dialogue. One commentator or news anchor after another simply dismisses the accusations as lies, et cetera, and on we go. I am extremely concerned that down the road somewhere, some of these accusations are going to be found to be true. There are sworn affidavits of good people that saw things happen, and they have been dismissed.
Sue, thanks a lot for the call. Maurice, can you talk about that a little? There have been affidavits in some of these cases where judges said these people didn't establish actual instances of fraud. Can you talk a little bit about Sue's concern, though?
Sure. And I think Sue has a point there, particularly in terms of, again, that there may be, and there's actually in the political science literature studies that show there's one thing to have sort of criminality, once again, corruption in the political election process. There's another in terms of having unclear administrative rules and regulations that are that may be unintentionally sort of broken and may lead to bad outcomes. So I would say in response to and to follow up just on what Sue said is that there probably should be after all of this is over, it should be once again, I think, a federal grant system where the federal government provides states resources so that state governments, either individually or working together, can look at, again, improving and modernizing our campaign election system. What I'm talking about, this is nothing new. Following the 2000 presidential election, Bush v. Gore, that's exactly what the government did with the what's called the HAVA Act, the Help America Vote Act, that the federal government provided state governments across the country funding to help modernize the voting equipment and also look at developing better ballot design. I think we may need something along those lines after this election cycle sort of wraps up. I'd like to call it a HAVA 2.0.
In our last minute or so, Maurice, what are you looking for when it comes to possible changes, maybe in states like Wisconsin, where there is this post-election dispute over some of those procedures you were just talking about and how state statutes were interpreted by the Wisconsin Elections Commission?
Sure. At the state level here in Wisconsin, I think one thing that we can do is perhaps reexamine, once again, the state election regulatory oversight. We used to have the Government Accountability Board that was replaced with the new Elections Commission. You know, we may need to look at that agency again to see exactly, is it properly staffed? Do they have enough, once again, resources and equipment? And also, again, get feedback from voters in terms of what are some of the issues that they witnessed, as Sue pointed out, and what can we do to, again, make sure that we have free and fair democratic elections in Wisconsin.
Maurice, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Maurice Shepherd is an instructor of political science at Madison College. He talked to us about what's next in the lead up to Inauguration Day after electors in Wisconsin and the rest of the country cast their votes today for the next president. Edward Anderson was a dairy farmer, a father, and a veteran of World War II. He died in November from COVID-19. He was 97 years old. This week, as we approach the end of 2020, WPR is profiling some of the people we lost to the pandemic. Rob Mentzer has this remembrance.
Edward Anderson spent 4 months as a prisoner of war. It was 1944, and the prison camps were full, so the Nazis forced him and about 2,000 other American captives to march for hundreds of miles. When they ate anything, they ate grass soup. Ed kept a secret diary of his time as a prisoner. His daughter, Sandra Cherney, still has it. On the back of it, he wrote a list of foods he imagined eating when he got home.
Tapioca pudding, and he had pie, apple pie, cheese.
Ed grew up on a dairy farm in Barron County. He was 20 years old when he was drafted to fight in World War II. He was captured in Belgium in the Battle of the Bulge. A newsreel from 1944 documented the battle for Americans at home.
The Nazi Party is willing to sacrifice every building and every soul in Germany to stave off defeat. The war is conducted in mist and turmoil and uncertainty.
We were running out of food, ammunition, what have you. I ended up with a bunch of wounded down in the basement of a house, and that's where the Germans saw me.
There aren't any recordings of Edward Anderson, but in 1991, his friend Wayne Erickson gave an oral history interview to the Wisconsin Veterans Museum. The two men grew up 10 miles away from each other, but they met as prisoners of war. Erickson died in 2003. Of the thousands captured, Erickson said fewer than 500 survived.
Well, some just collapsed, some were shot, Some froze to death. Some, we have no way of knowing what happened to some. Some we do, but some we don't.
Ed weighed less than 100 pounds when American troops liberated them. He came home and got married. He took over the dairy farm from his dad, and he drove a milk truck. Ed and his wife had two kids, Sandra and her brother Lee, who died in a motorcycle accident in 1973. Sandra says when she was a child, her father was always very busy. He didn't talk much and never talked about the war.
He was a man of very few words when it came to talking about himself.
She was an adult when she learned about his experiences. And in 2016, the Barron County Veterans Service Office and a congressman presented Ed with a POW medal. He enjoyed the ceremony, Sandra says, but he was still reserved. He didn't speak except to say thank you. Sandra is 74 now. She lives in Texas, but she video chatted with her dad regularly. In early November, she and the staffers at his nursing home were making plans to celebrate his birthday.
By 5 that afternoon, they called me. It was about 4:45, and they said, your dad's running a fever. We're going to do the fast test, which they did, and he was positive.
Ed had COVID-19.
He did live through the night. I FaceTimed with him in the afternoon of the next day, and he lived one more day. He lived 48 hours after he contracted the virus.
Sandra says she knew her dad could go at any time, but it was still a shock. He was doing well for his age. Sandra was looking forward to visiting him in 2021. It feels unfair that the pandemic took him. She thought she'd have a few more years with him. Ed died 2 weeks before his 98th birthday. Rob Menser, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Been checking in with some well-loved authors in the state about what they've been reading and spending their time on during the pandemic. We have a nonfiction-focused writer from Eau Claire joining us today, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What have you been reading lately? Have you been returning to previous favorites, enjoying something unexpected? Do you read a lot of nonfiction or personal essays? Do you have one you'd like to recommend to us? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. BJ Hollers is the author of several books, most recently Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. He's founder and executive director of the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, an associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire, and a columnist for the Leader Telegram. BJ, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Rob.
Well, some people, BJ, I know, have taken the opportunity with all the bad stuff out there in the pandemic to, I don't know, enjoy a slower pace of life a little bit, maybe settle in for more reading. Is that something you've been able to experience this year?
Absolutely. You know, somehow with all this quote unquote new time, there's still not enough of it, you know, but I have certainly done my part to curl up with as many books, and not just reading them, but audiobooks as well. Any way I can take a book with me, that's what I try to do.
And before we get to what you've been reading and maybe some recommendations you can share with us, I've been asking a lot of different writers like this. What has this year been like for you as a writer?
Oh, you know, it's been a year to be sure. A lot of my friends who have books coming out this year, I mean, were just devastated. Of course, there goes the book tour. There goes a lot of their income. I was fortunate that my book came out last year, and so at least I wasn't struck that way. But for me, it's just really been a focus of my writing. There's a book I actually put together coming out next year with Wisconsin Historical Society Press called Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Perseverance in Pandemic. And basically it's 100 writers from across the state kind of telling me where they're getting their hope in these times. And the answers will surprise you. And it was just really a heartwarming project for me to kind of find some purpose during my own kind of strange year.
I wanted to ask you about that. When is that supposed to come out next year? It's an exciting project for a lot of different Wisconsin writers.
Absolutely. No, it was so fun. I think it comes out in September and it should cover the state pretty well. We have writers from all walks of life, all places, everything from a 13-year-old to an octogenarian. And so we get a really good group of folks in there.
Now, you tend to write nonfiction and essays. Does that mean, therefore, that you tend to read in those genres too, BJ?
You know, sometimes I do. In fact, I would say kind of long form nonfiction is sort of my favorite thing to read these days. And that's very much been the case during the pandemic.
Now let's get into some recommendations, Al. I want to start naming names here. You've got some Wisconsin-focused history ones and essays and poetry, I think, on your list. Let's start local a little bit. Give us a couple titles.
Absolutely. You know, and this is a great time to support local artists, local writers, and that's sort of where my reading went this year. And so a couple that really stand out, the first one that I just wrapped up for the kind of regional political buffs out there, a new book by Dennis Dresson called Patrick J. Lucy, A Lasting Legacy, just came out from Wisconsin Historical Society Press, all about our former governor, 1971 through 1977. Of course, Lucy was Wisconsin's governor, but he had a really great story even before he got in that particular position. So I can't tell you what a great time I had reading this book, learning about how he kind of reshaped the Democratic Party when it was on the outs in the 50s and the early 60s, and how his work not only redefined Wisconsin politics, but also had a big role in JFK winning the primary in 1960 and helping get him into the Oval Office.
Talking to BJ Hollers, associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire and author, founder of the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild. It's part of our series of conversations with Wisconsin authors, getting some reading recommendations, and you could join the fun with your reading recommendation. What are you reading right now? What kind of things have you been reading during the pandemic? Do you have something, maybe even nonfiction or essay in particular, to share with us today? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. BJ, you've also got some Wisconsin poetry on your list for us.
Absolutely. There's a book that just came out. It's edited by our Wisconsin Poet Laureate, Margaret Roska, as well as the Madison Poet Laureate, Angie Trudell Vasquez. It's called Through This Door, Wisconsin in Poems. Just came out a couple months ago, has dozens and dozens of contributors from across the state, including all the former Wisconsin Poet Laureates. And they kind of riff off the idea of doors and doorways as an access to new knowledge, which comes from the U.S. Poet Laureate, Joy Harjo. And so this book is kind of Wisconsin's chance to kind of make a mark in the poetry world, and it really does a great job of that.
And then these are turbulent times, and you've got a title for us there, especially as we see a change in leadership at the national level.
Absolutely. You know, I just picked up this book kind of on a whim one day. It's Doris Kearns Godwin's Leadership in Turbulent Times. And of course, Kearns Godwin is a really well-known historian. She wrote Team of Rivals, who a lot of folks know. And what I love about this book is it doesn't limit itself to a single president. She sort of specializes in presidential history. Instead, it's all built around this idea of leadership. And so she goes through four presidents, Abraham Lincoln, Teddy Roosevelt, Franklin D. Roosevelt, and Lyndon Baines Johnson, and kind of talks about those key setbacks and moments in their lives that encouraged them to rise up and really kind of reaffirm who they were and what they wanted to do for the world.
And then this one I love. You've got a Charles Schulz book on your list. We had a great conversation about Charles Schulz by somebody who'd put together a book of essays about Charlie Brown and Snoopy and the Peanuts Gang. You've got Happiness is a Warm Puppy on your list for us.
Oh, absolutely. You know, I feel like this is the moment where we just need as much like comfort food, comfort reading, comfort everything, you know. And so this is a tiny little book. I read it on the last day of class for my college students right before final exams. And as I read it to the class, I assign each of them a singular page. And I tell them, when you're going through a hard time on that final exam, just remember this page. And so every page is something beautiful. Happiness is an umbrella and a new raincoat alongside a photo of Lucy in the rain, or happiness is a thumb and a blanket, you know, with Linus and his blanket. And so just something where every page is a little treat that you can kind of hold tight to.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Joyce is with us in Waniwak. Joyce, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to recommend, Joyce?
Well, it's Michael Perry, Wisconsin Humorist, I think you'd call him. The book that I happen to pick up is Truck, A Love Story, I think is the title of it. Kind of about his international truck from when he was growing up.
And yeah, are you a big Michael Perry fan, Joyce? Have you read other things by him?
I have not, but I've heard friends that have listened to him in person, you know, as a... Like I said, I believe he's a Wisconsin humorist. I mean, and it's true things from his life too. So it's just it's a good read. And my husband and I was saying, or reading it orally, we either read it, you know, when we're driving, one of us will read, or when we go to bed at night, we'll read it. And it's kind of a captivating little story, you know.
Thanks so much, Joyce. Yeah, Michael, essayist and humorist and musician and volunteer EMT or firefighter, I can't remember which, frequent guest here on the Ideas Network. And he writes essays, BJ, and I know you do as well. Do you have people you look to for great essay and maybe even memoir writing?
Oh, gosh, certainly. And just to follow up with Joyce there, I mean, Mike is a wonderful person to read. He's got a brand new book out called Peaceful Persistence. It just came out a few weeks ago. It makes a great Christmas gift, holiday gift. So be sure to pick out the new one, too. In terms of other essayists and writers I really like, I really like to look local. And there's an essayist and also kind of a nonfiction writer named John Hildebrand, who was the nonfiction professor here at UW-Eau Claire prior to my time here. So I really turn to his books a lot. He's got one called The Heart of Things, which is kind of an almanac of these very short vignettes, kind of like Mike Perry's work, that kind of get us through one full year in Wisconsin. So that's one of kind of shorter essays that I really enjoy.
Thank you so much for that call. I appreciate it. At 800-642-1234. We're talking to BJ Hollers, author, founder and executive director of the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild, associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He is sharing some reading recommendations with a focus on nonfiction. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is a book, nonfiction or otherwise, that you have enjoyed reading this year that you want to recommend to everybody else? What is on your list for the winter of reading? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with BJ Hollers, Eau Claire-based writer, associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire, talking about what he's enjoyed reading in the last few months. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. What would you like to recommend to other people to read? Do you need some suggestions? Fiction, nonfiction, let us know what you have been turning to this year for reading and what is on your list to read in the winter. Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We got a comment on Facebook from Tim. He says, hi, BJ. Stamped by Ibram Kendi and a co-author in How to Be Anti-Racist by Kendi have been amazing and eye-opening. And I think a lot of people have been turning to books, BJ, this year about race, racial relationships, and their history in the United States.
Absolutely. And I've been right there with them. That book is incredible. I actually listened to it as an audiobook in June. And other books, White Fragility, there's such a great lineup of books that are being very well received and are teaching folks, especially white folks, a lot of things that perhaps we weren't fully aware of prior to this summer. And so that's a great example. One that I've been looking to, it's a bit further back. It's not quite as trending, I suppose, but in other ways it is. It's written by none other than the late Congressman John Lewis. And so over the summer, I went back and reflected on his memoir. It's called Walking with the Wind, a memoir of the movement. And I just love this book. I've already talked about some of the more American history books that I've been reading, but this one tells it in a very poignant way, in a very personal way. There's a new documentary out, of course, Good Trouble, about John Lewis's life. And you know, ever since his passing a few months back, I think America has really taken note of just what a giant he was in the Congress and beyond. And so certainly as heroes go, he's one of mine. It's been a pleasure to hear some of his personal stories about what kind of motivated him to make the change that we needed in this country.
Thanks to Tim for the comment on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can keep sharing your recommendations at 800-642-1234. BJ, I've talked to some writers who have gotten into rereading this year. Have you done any of that, turned back to an old favorite?
Oh, my goodness, yes. And then again, that goes back to the comfort reading. There are some books where there's some moments, I suppose, or reading experiences where you don't want the surprise. You want to know exactly how it's going to go. And so I recently unearthed the gentlest book I have ever read. It was published in 1957. It was a runner-up for the Newbery Honor, I believe. It's called Gone Away Lake by Elizabeth Enright. I read this, or had it read to me, in like first grade, but it holds up. It's about an 11-year-old named Portia and her cousin Julian. They wander through the swamps and the woods one day, and they come across this like dried up lake with all these abandoned houses. And within these houses, there's an elderly brother and sister. And so now you've got these 11-year-olds befriending these elderly people in the middle of nowhere. It's just this beautiful intergenerational tale. What I love about it is it could never be published today. There's no antagonist. There's no plot. It's just like charm from page one to page whatever it goes up to. It's just a pleasure.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Tony is with us in Stevens Point. Tony, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Tony?
I just recently read a book by Gordon Parks. And it's called Choose Your Weapon. I enjoyed it quite a bit. It's basically his autobiography of a young Gordon Parks. And then I read, just picked up a book that's somewhat topical, December 7th, called Infamy. And it's the aftermath and history of Pearl Harbor, written by John Tolan, a Wisconsin writer.
Oh, interesting. Thank you for those suggestions. That first one, an autobiography, and that's one genre I didn't ask too much about, BJ. Anybody else? I mean, we heard John Lewis, of course, in his memoir. Any place else you go for biography and autobiography?
Oh, those are great recommendations. Thanks for those, Tim. You know, I've been reading a lot again about kind of 1960s Wisconsin and 1960s kind of political times. And so there's a book, it's sort of biography, but it's more like the biography of a campaign. It's called The Making of the President 1960 by Theodore H. White. So it was I believe a Pulitzer Prize winner back in the day. And it really covers, again, these kind of personal moments in the Kennedy campaign. There's a great section there in Wisconsin. And so that's kind of how I like my history, through stories. And so that's kind of what I've been reading in that regard.
That calls to mind one that I thought I might recommend today, a book about President James Garfield and his assassination. Huh. It's called Destiny of the Republic by Candace Millard. Okay. And I appreciate history books sometimes where the truth is so much stranger than any fiction author could get away with. Like if a novelist put in details like what actually happened there, you wouldn't believe it. So that is one that I've recommended a lot to people over the last year or so. I won't go into details. It gets a little gruesome, but definitely worth a read in that genre. Let's go back to our callers now. We've got Connie with us now in Madison. Connie, hi.
Hi there. I had a recommendation of two books I just finished by the same author, Jeff Nania. He's a former Dane County police officer, and he's second career has been in ecology, restoring wetlands. And his third career now is writing. One book is called Figure Eight, and the other is Spider Lake, and they take place in northern Wisconsin. They're two mysteries.
Ooh.
That's and they're good mysteries? You're liking these?
Oh, good. Yeah, very easy reads, good mysteries, and the Figure Eight is the first book, and the Spider Lake is the continuation of what happens after the first book. So the Figure Eight should be the first book read.
Connie, thank you so much for sharing those with us. Wisconsin mysteries. I don't read a ton of mysteries, BJ, but when I do, I'm like, well, I don't know, maybe I should read more. I usually tend to like at least the ones that people recommend to me. Is that do you go in that direction at all ever?
You know, more and more, especially as the pandemic drags on, I've been going to some kind of lighter fare and kind of more just enjoyable beach read kind of stuff. And there are some books, they aren't certainly beach reads, but they get the pages moving. There's something called the Natchez Trilogy by Greg Isles, Natchez Burning, and two other books, kind of these southern tales of murder and mystery. And you know, they're pretty PG-13 R-rated. I'll put that out there. But you can get through 600 pages in 2.5 days. So if you want to just kind of take a vacation from this world for a bit, those are wonderful books to get you there.
Thanks for the call and the recommendations. Bruce joins us next in Trevor. Bruce, hello.
Hi. Yeah, with the Trump presidency, I've been really interested in Bob Woodward's book, Rage. Couldn't put that down. And then we got Michael Cohen's book, and I wasn't sure I wanted to read that, but my God, what a fascinating read that is.
Bruce, thanks a lot for that call. And that's going in the opposite direction of what you're just saying, BJ. Sometimes we want to move away from the latest in the world. Sometimes, as Bruce does, we want to take it head on. And I think there's been a lot of interest across the political spectrum in reading about President Trump this year.
Absolutely. And more power to Bruce for going there. Gosh, I can barely handle the daily news, you know. I find myself, again, moving in the opposite direction. I'm looking more historical about, not that I'm not interested in current politics. I'm so much more interested in kind of what were politics like in 1960, in 1970. Were they always this partisan? And so I'm learning a lot about that, you know, and I'm sure they had their their dark moments then as well. But there are these moments of bipartisanship, and the Lucy book goes back to that. He was really a bridge builder in a lot of ways. So I really took a lot of heart in learning about the historical past and the political past.
Thanks for the call, Bruce. Talking to BJ Hollers from UW-Eau Claire, an author. He's sharing some recommendations, and so are you, for reading. Nita joins us next in Houstonsford. Nita, hello.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. Michael Perry is also one of my very favorite all-time authors, but today I'm calling about Alexander McCall Smith. He wrote like a series of Number One Ladies Detective Agency novels. Yeah. They made a PBS series out of it. And he has a lot of other books out there. Right now, I just read The Minor Adjustment Beauty Salon. It has the same characters as the detective agency novels. And it's like these books are just so calming. There's, you know, it's like these people never, you know, they're so patient. And it's such a low-key book. And I loved it at this time. You know, there was nothing, nothing to get your blood pressure up or anything. It was just so, you know, just kind of went along and took you with it.
Nita, thank you so much for sharing that. And BJ, actually, there's an idea that Nita touched on that you've kind of hinted at as well. The idea of reading as kind of a therapy in tough times. Does it work that way for you?
Yeah, I was just telling my wife yesterday, this is the only thing that seems to center me right now. You know, there's just so much to worry about. Your phone's always dinging. Someone always needs something. But when you're alone with a book and there's just a moment of quiet, just you and the turning of the page is a real pleasurable moment for me. That's for sure.
Thank you, Nita, so much for that call and suggestion. BJ, just a minute or so left. What is on your to-read list or stack or queue or whatever it might be for the winter?
I have two books right next to me I'm so excited about. The first is kind of that calming book again. It lowers the blood pressure. I just started. It's called This Is Happiness by Niall Williams. Just kind of set in this Western Irish town many years ago. And it's just such gorgeous prose. The other one, the last one I'll mention, I don't think my wife is listening, so I'll mention it's for her Christmas present. It's Yaa Gyasi's Transcendent Kingdom. And so she's the author of Homegoing, and this is her follow-up. It's supposed to be fantastic. So I can't wait to read it.
Well, mine waiting for me right now at the library for curbside pickup. I've never read Pride and Prejudice, and both my wonderful folks are raving about it again lately. So I'm like, okay, I'm gonna give it a shot.
Won't regret it.
I will like it. Good. I'll hold you to that promise. BJ, thanks a lot for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Rob.
BJ Hollers is the author of several books, including Midwestern Strange, Hunting Monsters, Martians, and the Weird in Flyover Country. He's founder and executive director of the Chippewa Valley Writers Guild and an associate professor of English at UW-Eau Claire. He joined us to talk about what he's been reading lately, to share some suggestions. He's the editor of a forthcoming anthology, as he mentioned earlier, 100 Writers from Around Wisconsin, titled Hope is the Thing, Wisconsinites on Hope and Resilience in the Time of COVID-19. Cast your mind back to April of 2019. That's when I shared with you some earth-shattering news of a record-setting pizza made in Australia with 154 different kinds of cheese. It was a world record, according to Guinness. It was, but it is no more. Throw that pizza in the trash with its paltry 154 kinds of cheese and kneel down before the new cheese overlord with 254 varieties of cheese. As reported by Grub Street, a French chef in Lyon felt that national honor was at stake, so he set about setting a record. He actually made the pizza back in February. For some reason, it took this long for Guinness to verify the achievement. Technically, he ended up adding three extra cheeses right at the end, bringing the total to 257. The last three didn't end up on the video evidence he provided to Guinness. So far, I haven't seen the full cheese list. He released a video, and some observers saw cheeses like Rocamadour, Manigodin, La Vialouche, and a bunch of others that I haven't heard of and can't really pronounce. I also can't find info about what the pizza actually tasted like. More important, this pizza aggression cannot stand, man. When will Wisconsin rise to the challenge? Start collecting cheese, at least 258 flavors, just to be on the safe side. Cheese news you can use. This is Central Time.